Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
What's it like when one of your friends on death row is led away to be executed?
You have a prepaid call from
William A. Papiro,
an inmate at the California State Prison, San Quentin. This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
I had to be a different police guy, which is the guy who walked walkways of San Quentin death row, and without a gang, without a group of people around me. It was just me.
Soon after you went into to be on death row, and you didn't really understand the prison workout system so much, but then he said, we're going to do 75 sets of it. To me, that seems extreme. So I'm wondering if there's a danger of overtraining, wearing yourself out so that you're...
No, that's actually funny. That's funny. I'll tell you why. That's a good one, man. I'll tell you why.
Welcome to Death Row Diaries. I'm Matt Ralston.
And I'm William Nogueira.
And we have a really interesting case today. I had never heard of this guy, Robert Ben Rhodes. What's he called? The truck stop killer? What's his name?
Yeah, he's the truck stop killer. And one of our listeners on Patreon suggested that we look at this guy and really take a look at him. And, you know, honestly, I had heard of him. I knew who he was, but I never really studied the case as well in depth as I have over the last few days. And man, one of our Patreon subscribers, which I won't mention their name. I know they said they didn't want to be mentioned, but look, they picked a real good one. This guy is a special insect right here.
Yeah. Yeah, this is really depraved, scary stuff. So we'll get into it. Just want to remind everyone to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Death Row Diaries, and definitely check out our Patreon page. That is patreon.com/Death Row Diaries, where you will get bonus content. We're shooting for an episode a week. Maybe it's three a month. We're still getting this figured out. We're doing the best we can. Before we start, Bill, I meant to ask you, this must be a really exciting week for you, because you might get to meet a celebrity in prison.
Yeah, you're right. Actually, I already saw him.
Were you a fan of that 70s show? I wasn't really.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie to you. Yeah, I am a fan of that show. I still watch some of the reruns sometimes, you know? I mean, what can we say? You know, Donna was a really beautiful girl, right?
Sure. Yeah, it wasn't a bad show. I really like the dad, the guy who played the dad. He's in the show Patriot that I love. So is Masterson going to, yeah. Danny Masterson's going to have an okay time there in Corcoran?
Well, he's not on my yard, but he came into R&R a couple days ago. He's on the 3A yard, which is a level 3 prison. You know, I don't know how he's going to do. I don't know if, it really depends on how he acts and how he conducts himself, but yeah, he's here, and I'm sure he's going to find out really quickly that, you know, prison for child actors or whatever, it's not really the funnest place in the world. People think that you're rich right away. There's going to be people pressuring him. There's going to be people, you know, some guys watch these shows and they think that it's still him from that time. They're going to ask him, you know, what's Donna's phone number? What's Fez is, you know, what's Fez really like? It's going to be an interesting time for him. You know, he's been a free guy all these years, and now he is going to be dealing with convicts, killers, rapists, child molesters, all kinds of weirdos. Well, maybe he might be right at home. You never know.
Yeah. Well, he's a rapist, but not maybe the same kind. I don't know. So Rhodes, this guy's just a freak. This guy's an S&M freak. And he tortures and he kills a lot. Now, I guess if we want to go to the beginning of the story, we do know that his dad was a pedophile, right?
He was. His father was arrested for molesting, and I say alleged because he was charged, but before he can go to trial, his father committed suicide. So we don't know exactly the facts of that case, only that he was arrested and charged with the molestation of a 12-year-old little girl.
Yeah, so that's a pretty bad sign. You know, I don't know. I don't know for a fact that he did it. I would say getting charged is even a bad sign. But what do we know about his upbringing?
Yeah, so from the beginning, he's known as a truck stop killer. His name is Robert Ben Rhodes. And he is considered, and he is, an American serial killer. He has the he was convicted of 4 murders. But don't let that fool you. This guy actually killed upwards of 50 women by torture, rape, and it didn't matter. It could have been girls of the age of between 12 and fully grown women. So this guy is exactly that. He was active between 1975 and 1990 as a killer. You know, it's a little deceptive because in most reports about him, they say, well, he's guilty of killing 4 people, 2 couples. Although that may be true, it is also misleading. This guy killed those couple because, and he was caught for those couple. The bodies were found, and he confessed to them, so we know he did that. But he killed a lot more people. He had a cab that was rigged for an overnight sleeper. It was a torture chamber. It had chains. It had whips. He had a very special suitcase with all these different toys and torture devices. But this guy was a special type of killer, but I did jump ahead of myself there. So let's go to his beginnings. He was born in Council Bluffs, Iowa. He was raised by his mother at first until his father left the army. He was stationed in West Germany, by the way. And his father then became a firefighter. There really is no signs of any type of abuse or any type of signs that he actually was going to become a serial killer. I've mentioned this before. Sometimes serial killers feel around the dark. They light fires. They torture animals. They become peeping toms because they're trying to figure out who they are. With this guy, we have no signs of anything. The first time that we hear of any type of red flag, he's already well into high school. And by the way, he's an athlete, a wrestler. He played football. He was in a French club. This guy was not unpopular. Girls dated him. But at the age of 16, he was arrested for tampering with a car. And basically, that can mean anything. That can mean that he played with the mirror, he tried to open the door, he lifted the hood to look at the engine. You never know. It just says tampering with a car. And then at age 17, which is 1962 by this time, he is arrested for a fight. Now, there's not a whole lot there. I can't say that. I don't know, maybe 60% of kids in high school get in some type of trouble like this, a fight here, a fight there. Not that big of a deal. I don't see any signs here that would lead me to believe that this guy was a sexual sadist, that he would enter the BDSM scene and become, well, an extremely prolific serial killer.
Yeah, he's a... apparently a charming guy. He's a good looking guy. He looks like a normal guy, like a, you know, a nice guy. And yeah, I mean, I feel like the leather scene was more common back then. I mean, it was always a little weird, but I'm sure most of it was harmless, right? But you know, I guess if you're into BDSM, that could mean a lot of things. It could be kind of a goofy thing you do, or you could, you know, you could really want to be hurting people as well.
Right. So that's interesting you say that. So he is involved in the BDSM scene, bondage, domination. So it's interesting for me because looking at him now, you see that he's able, by the way, most serial rapists, killers, they're most of the time they're pretty to themselves. They don't allow anybody to know who they are. And quite frankly, when they do get caught, people think, man, I had no idea this guy was that guy. But this guy's different. He's involved in the S&M movement. He's in that scene. He's, you know, shipped chains, whips. He likes this type of stuff. And it's almost like he's having a glass of wine before he goes into hard liquor. It's really interesting because he is one of those rare guys that indulges in his fantasy, but he's not totally living it out. And with this guy, you can tell that his occupation basically opened the door for him to do what he wanted to do. And so, why I say that. So, there are people you see, there's pedophiles that live next to schools or close to elementary schools. And if you're able to catch them doing what they do, they're looking at kids, they're fantasizing about kids, but they actually don't go out there and grab a kid and do anything to them. And this guy does something similar to that by being in the S&M scene. He's getting a taste of what he likes, but he can control it. So he's basically sipping at the wine and not really indulging in the whole bottle, if that brings it any closer to you. But when he graduates from high school, and by the way, he did graduate, he went into the to the Marine Corps, and he was then dishonorably discharged. In other words, he fucked up. And how he fucked up was that he went and became involved in a robbery.
So he's involved in a robbery.
Yeah, this guy isn't the perfect guy. He's not a choir boy. He's not a Boy Scout. But nothing there tells me that this guy's, he's really a bad guy. He's going to start killing and raping. So obviously he leaves the Marine Corps, or they actually tell him to get the hell out of Dodge because they dishonor you, discharge him for robbery. Then he enters college, and, well, he's kicked out of there too. He tries to join law enforcement. He wants to become a cop. And that does not work out because he is rejected because obviously of the robbery he had and the reason he was discharged from the Marine Corps. So he goes from job to job. He tries to be a grocer. He tries to be a hardware store attendant. All these things lead him down a particular road, which is to become a long-haul trucker. And for me, it really does speak to this guy's frame of mind. Now, of course, long-haul truckers make pretty good money, but what it does is it puts you in a position where you can do a lot of thinking. So we hear about people that go to prison or they have crises in their life and they become self-reflective and they learn about themselves. With this guy, I believe the long-haul trucking, the time alone on the road, where he's thinking the whole time, serves as the breeding ground, what most guys do by lighting fires, torturing animals, and do all these little things. He's kind of stalking in his mind, he's developing in his mind, and he's, that scene that he likes, the BDSM, begins to evolve into something that he really is, but would have taken him a little bit longer to do it, but it's coming about, and it's coming about on the road. And look, we look at this guy after he is caught, but during that time that he is a long-haul trucker, a lot of stuff is going on. It becomes public that he is in the BDSM. He is not a horribly bad-looking guy. He marries actually three times. He has a child with his first wife. There is now a hint that he can be violent. His third wife, Deborah, reports that he was both sexually, physically, and emotionally abusive. That doesn't really say that he is a serial killer, because if that were the case, there'd be millions of guys every day arrested for being serial killers because of being abusive in their relationships. So, you know, we have no bodies. No one has linked this guy to anything, Matt. No one knows he exists. No one knows that he's doing these things. But he's actually already from around... law enforcement believe that by 1975, he is murdering and killing. He doesn't get caught till 1990, 15 years later. I believe that the killing started probably a little bit before that. But he obviously is doing this. They found in excess of 50 bodies. They can't directly link to him, but they were on his routes. Was he guilty of every one of them? Possibly. Probably not. But I'd say that a large portion of the women that they found, and the ones they didn't find, because remember, this guy would leave bodies in deserts where no one would find them, in barns. So, yeah, I'd say his number's around 50.
So, can we go back? You said he tried to be a grocer, a store clerk. Do you think that he just couldn't, handle interacting with people, like he's antisocial, like he actually couldn't do those jobs? Like a lot of troubled people, they just get fired from every job because they have conflicts with everyone, or they creep people out or whatever. But, you know, also the long haul trucking for a guy with only a high school diploma, no higher education, that was a good job back then. So do you think he fell into that because it was solitary and, you know, he didn't have to answer to anyone, or because it was a good job, or because he was planning on doing what he ended up doing?
Well, I think that all of the above are correct. I mean, I believe that a guy with only a high school diploma, this is a good job. I'm sure people told him these guys make good money. You answer to nobody. You have your own work schedule. As long as you make the right timing or make the schedule, you do what you want to do. I think that's attractive to a guy like this. I also believe that along the way, he probably saw or met someone that was a long-haul trucker that told him how it is. And I'm sure that those conversations happened. And he talked about truck stop lizards. It's a variation of names that they call these young girls, sometimes sex workers, that hang out at these truck stops. And I think that caught his attention. Now, I can't say for sure, but it's always along those lines. Guys usually don't start robbing banks or robbing a bunch of stuff unless someone hints them with, this could be lucrative or this can be a good idea. So I think he, along the way, found out about picking up people. That people, there's a lot of hitchhikers in the road, especially in the 1970s, a lot of people hitchhiked everywhere they went. It was right after the flower power movement. This is a very different time in the United States. And I think he took advantage of it. It's like I mentioned before, sometimes pedophiles will live close to schools. It's not that they're actually snatching the kids and doing anything, but they're fantasizing. They're using the ground for their own fertile brains when it comes to thinking about this stuff, and having a school right next to them makes it easier. With this guy, I think that had to do with it too. He knew he'd run across hitchhikers, and he knew he'd have an opportunity to actually kill.
Yeah, and he had a placard on his dashboard that said cash, grass, or ass, which I always thought was kind of funny in a crude way. But, you know, after reading this story, it's really not. So, you know, meaning those are the three forms of payment you give if you get a ride from the trucker. I always assumed it was a joke. But anyway, do you think that he starts off picking up hitchhikers, maybe wanting something consensual? Do you think he just wants to scare them, or how do you think it progresses, or does it? Do you think he kills the first hitchhiker that he picks up? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think he starts off just killing. There's a bit of hesitation there. After all, he is a human being, although one with no conscience and zero empathy for anyone. Look, and by the way, the saying is, ass, grass, or cash, no one rides for free. And I know that saying because in the 1970s, I had a poster like that on my freaking wall in my bedroom. So I know that it had a little guy smoking weed and a bunch of girls with, you know, large breasts and big booties. It was something a kid bought at a stoner shop. They used to call them, what was the name of those shops? They were called head shops.
Yeah.
You could buy bongs, you could buy stuff, but that poster was very famous in the 1970s, right. And people had it on their cars. Truckers are also guys that did this. So what I believe went on, and I think that his crimes tell the same story, is that, you know, he'd pick up these girls. He was already in the S&M, sexual sadist, whatever the hell you want to call it, scene. And this guy is, by the way, a sexual sadist. He enjoys to torture and hurt people, and he rapes, tortures them for weeks, and then he kills them. I believe that what happened was that, and we have evidence of this, by the way. This is not me speculating on what really happened. And I'll tell you what the case is. There was a young woman by the name of Shanna Holtz, and an 18-year-old girl. She was abducted by this monster, and she was placed in this bedroom behind the truck. It's kind of a cab. It's an overnight sleeping cab that big Peterbilt have. And in this particular one, he had her chained there, chained up. She was nude. He usually one of his signatures was he shaved their heads and he shaved their pubic hair. He was torturing her, and she managed to escape. She reported him to the police department. And when they actually arrested him, because they did arrest him for this, she declined to press charges because, and these are her words. So I want you to understand what the young woman's state of mind. And he had her for nearly 2 weeks. He was torturing her, raping her. He pierced parts of her. So after all this happens to this woman, who obviously was probably a hitchhiker, she may have been a sex worker, she says, I don't see any good in filing charges. It's just going to be my word against his. If there was evidence, I would file charges and sue him. Well, it was later found out that she was fearful because for 2 weeks he tortured her in that truck. As I mentioned, he is a sexual sadist. And part of the mechanism of sexual sadists is to be in control. Granted, most of the time they control their victim, being a man or a woman, through apparatuses like chains or different things to restrain them. Sometimes, and this is very true with these type of killers, they often... You've heard of cases where the victim of a serial killer is left to wander. She is asked to go into the store, but come right back. And she does. For the sexual sadist, for the rapist, for the serial killer, that is the biggest high of all. Because he controls her so much with fear that actually letting her go, she comes back. That is huge for this guy. And he makes that mistake by letting Shauna free of her restraint. And she actually leaves. But she doesn't press charges, and he's let go. Let me call you back.
Yeah, I was confused when I was reading about this because... So she goes to the police, and I guess we don't know. Did she tell them that she had been tortured? Did she tell them that she had been tortured for... several weeks in a very brutal way. And I don't know the laws. I feel like now there's a chance that they would prosecute him anyway, or at least they would nab him for something, or at least he would be on their radar. And it seems like he was just allowed to skate free on this?
Well, remember, it's 1990, and he's not known to be a serial killer. No one knows about him, but it is true. You have these victims who may at first go to the police department, and look, let's be honest, and I know the audience knows this because we've talked about it, and other people have talked about it. Law enforcement has talked about it. In the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, and even in sometime in the 2000s, these young ladies were considered expendable, disposables. And because they were at truck stops, because they were hitchhikers, because they may have been sex workers, police usually identified them with high-risk groups. So if they were a high-risk group, no one believed them because they believed that in some way, somehow, they'd get blamed for this. This happened because they put themselves in this position. That isn't what I feel. That isn't what Matt feels. But this is what how it really was in that field, which was law enforcement. And we've heard about this in numerous occasions. You watch 2020, 48 Hours, and they talk about this. So this isn't something that I'm making up. So she, by her own statement, it's my word against his. That she's already telling you that she believes she's not going to be trusted. Her word is not going to be held to a high degree. So she felt that it was useless. Obviously, when someone puts someone in their truck, he tortures them. He keeps them in the back. He shaves them their heads. They should have known something was wrong. But, you know, a lot of cases...
Well,
sometimes it's not easy.
Couldn't they at least pull him over? If they would have just looked in the cab of his truck, they would have found basically a torture chamber.
Well, they knew that he had all this stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, she told them, but she didn't press charges. And back then, if you didn't press charges, then let the guy go. You know, it isn't until the early morning of April the 1st, 1990, that right outside of Casa Grande, Arizona, a Peterbilt is on the side of the road. Its hazard lights are flashing. It's near Interstate 10. And a state trooper named Mike Miller pulls over. He is, by the way, he is a Arizona Highway Patrol. And when he goes to investigate, because he sees the truck may be in peril, there may be something wrong. Sometimes these big guys and these big trucks pull over because there's something definitely wrong with the truck. This state trooper, he gets out to investigate. When he does, he finds a young woman nude in the truck that he's just looking at. She's handcuffed. She's screaming. And there's a male present. And he identifies himself as the owner of the truck. Who is that person? Well, ladies and gentlemen, it is our friend, Robert Ben Rhodes. And he's a cool customer. He immediately tells the officer, look, this isn't what it looks. I'm carrying a gun. I have a permit for it. It's right there. And I like it. The cop says this guy's cool. He definitely tells him there's a gun in the truck, so there's no misunderstanding. The cop actually thinks this guy's a good guy, but there's something telling him. There's a girl right there. She's screaming. She is dehydrated. She has welts all over her body. She's been pierced with objects. And the officer immediately arrests him. He charges him. I mean, what I mean by charges him, he handcuffs him. He puts him in the back of the squad car. And he goes back to investigate to see in what state the young woman is in. He gets there. He uncuffs her. He calls for backup. By the time that he gets the new squad car shows up, Rhodes has uncuffed himself. He's put the cuffs in front of him. He's about to uncuff himself. Of course, the other officer helps, and they take him in, and they begin to investigate this whole situation. They get a warrant to go into Rose's home, and then this is when they start finding all the telltale signs that we find with serial killers. There are photographs. There are trophies. One of the photographs found is that of a young woman that was found also in 1990, and her name was Patricia Candace Walsh. She's 24 years old. Her and her 26-year-old husband, Douglas Scott Sombrowski. I'm sure I mispronounced that, but I'm sorry about that. They're from Seattle, Washington, and they went missing shortly after leaving the city of Washington in 1989. Her husband, Sombrowski's remains were discovered in January of 1990 in Ozona, Texas, again near that famous interstate, Interstate 10, that he loves to drive by. The body was not identified till 1992, and then Walsh, a young woman, was also identified in Utah. She was found, and her body was identified, and after Rhodes, of course, was arrested, he confessed to their murders. He also claimed that they were hitchhiking. He picked them up. He first killed the husband, dumped his body in Sutton County, Texas. It's exactly where he was found. And he kept Walsh for over a week, torturing her, raping her, cutting her, and then he dumped the body in Millard County, Utah. So he gets arrested, and right away, now he starts talking about what he did.
So do you think at this point, I'm guessing, well, obviously he'd been killing for a while, but I'm wondering, you know, not restraining the girl prior and then kind of parking essentially in the middle of a highway with your hazards on, pretty brazen. So is he becoming more brazen, or is he just kind of dropping the ball?
Well, I think that a little bit, well, obviously both are true, but he's brazen. And remember, he is speeding up. He is raping, killing. He's got Miss Walsh. She kills her husband. He kills her husband. He takes Shanna Holtz, who, despite being arrested, she drops the charges. That was only a month after Walsh and Zakowski are missing, because he murdered them. And then comes right after this, and the reason I'm mentioning this, because we haven't gotten to this yet, is that Regina K. Walters, she's only 14 years old, and she's found badly decomposed in September 29, 1990, in the loft of an abandoned barn. She'd been missing since February 3rd, 1990. What's so significant to that is that you have Miss Walsh and her husband, January 1990. You have Shanna Holtz the following month. You have Regina K. Walters and her 18-year-old boyfriend, which that leaves a lot to be raising eyebrows there, because 14-year-old girl, 18-year-old boyfriend. And right away, you see the pattern. That was February the 3rd when they went missing. He is speeding up. You see it? So then in April, which is a month and a half from the time that he kills Regina and Ricky, he's doing it again. But this time, they catch him. What's going on, to answer your question, is he's chasing the rush. As serial killers who are, they're moved by impulse, by the need for the rush. He is in his truck. He has this woman in the back. He's feeling it. And he doesn't care where he's at. He pulls over to the side of the road, hits his hazards, and decides now is the time to go on with this. So it's him just basically paying attention to his instincts. And his instincts tell him to do this. Unfortunately, and unfortunately, they're able to stop him from killing this young woman. And Mike Miller is a hero because of that. But it's just brazen. This guy is, and look, you have 4 months right there of him going faster, faster, and faster. And we see this in a number of serial killer cases. This guy's a sexual sadist. This didn't just start in 1990. He has hinted they started in 1975 with this type of behavior. I completely believe that. He is he's already on the path to taking it to a different level. He's chasing the rush. It takes sometimes years to begin to chase the rush to that level. And that's what we have with this guy.
Yeah. So with Regina, the 14-year-old girl, there are photos that are online that have been cropped. You know, there's nothing graphic, but he was taking photos of her, and they found these photos. Have you seen these photos?
I have not seen them, and I honestly, they would be very disturbing to me that a 14-year-old child was tortured in this way by a sexual sadist.
Yeah, it's pretty horrifying, but I don't know if iconic. It's infamous. These photos are because of how blood curdling they are, and there's nothing graphic that you can find online, or at least not, you know, with a regular search. But it's just the look in her eyes is very terrifying and heartbreaking. So, what kind of fight does he put up? Is he lying, or is it over?
Well, it's over. He's trying to smooth talk his way. It's very difficult. A young woman screaming that this guy's been torturing her. Nipples have been pierced. Her different sexual body parts are pierced because he's done it. Look, this guy even went as far as calling one of the victim's fathers and telling him what he was going to do to her. This guy's a real piece of work. And all I can say is that, I'm glad that he's arrested, but it really does show you the kind of people that have been driving the highways. Young ladies, young boys, they think that hitchhiking is okay, and it really isn't. You are at the mercy of the person in that car or in that truck. And what happened here, this guy was a public guy. He had an entire torture chamber inside of his cab. And if you don't know, these cabs have, right behind the driver's cab, they have like a small apartment. It's, you see a bed, you have a television in there. I'm sure in today's world, they probably have more than that. But you can access it through the trailer. So you're in the driver's seat, you can just go behind it and just walk into the back. Now, is that really dangerous? Sure, because you get pulled over, a cop can immediately search your car or your truck and find it. But he had that girl right there. So you can imagine the type of sexual high he was getting by driving. She is right behind him. He can hear her. He's probably talking to her, telling her what he's going to do to her, and he's just feeding on her fear. Let me call back.
Yeah, so I had a few thoughts, none of them too profound. If he's got the torture chamber in the cab, I'm wondering where he's sleeping. I guess that would mean he just has to sleep sitting up, maybe, but he's driving thousands of miles, traversing the whole country. More importantly, I guess he would have to own this truck, right? Because he can't bring it back to the company with the torture chamber in the back, or... but those are all neither here nor there, I guess.
No, that's actually, the truck was his. Mm-hmm. This is a private truck. These Peterbilts, you just attach your truck to the trailer and you haul whatever they want you to haul. This was his truck. So the Peterbilt part, which is the where the engine, the driver's seat, and that part is the part that you can detach, that is his. The part that he hauls more than likely was something he picked up and he hauled it, or it was his entire trailer and he would have it loaded with whatever, and then he would take that. So no one would see that trailer unless they pulled over and a cop stepped up and looked inside. That would be a different situation. I'm sure he had some kind of a door that would be closed, but when he went to sleep, he would just crawl into that back space right there, and there's usually something like a twin-size bed back there. So he could have slept very easily with his victims tied right there next to him.
Right. So when I look at the his little kinks or whatever, the needles, you know, poking through nipples and whatnot, I've seen that before, and I think that's pretty self-explanatory. It's kind of inflicting a lot of pain and whatever. The shaving of the head, I don't understand what that's about.
Oh, I'll tell you. So Regina, the 14-year-old girl, when they found her in that barn, she'd been strangled to death with a wire and a wooden type of beam behind her. So he twisted it to kill her. He strangled her to death. And of course, he kept twisting it in order to inflict the most damage to the body. I've talked about damaging, that serial killers like to damage the body. And that also is a part of their, you know, this crazed lunacy that they like, by destroying the body any way they can. With him, his signature was that he would shave the heads and then he would shave the pubic hair area. That's the signature, not the MO. The MO is what he does, how he lures the victim, how he gets them, and that is that he drives around, he picks up hitchhikers, sex workers, he lures them in a truck, offering them a ride, offering them to get high, whatever. And that's his MO. That's how he does it. The signature is not something he does that helps him kill. The signature is what he does, what he thinks. It's like a ritual for him. So as I've talked about this before, you see basketball players and they come to the free throw line, they touch their head, they bounce the ball twice, they breathe twice, they shrug their shoulders, and then they shoot the ball. They do it every single time they shoot the ball. Baseball players do something very similar. They touch their glove, they hit their hat twice, they touch their ankles, all this crazy stuff they do, and they do it every single time they prepare to go bat. And each time the ball is pitched, they do it again. That's a ritual. That's a signature. So imagine that in a killer's atmosphere. When he shaves the head, he shaves the pubic hair, that's his ritual.
And he was also really into having white towels. I guess when they searched his apartment, they found many, many white towels. But he always had white towels, some of them with blood on them. To me, what seems like an obvious explanation is he wants to see the blood collecting on the towel. You know, if blood falls onto a concrete floor or whatever the cab of his truck is, you know, black rubber, whatever. But, you know, when it falls on a white towel, just like on snow, you know, it's bright, brilliant red. That's what I'm assuming that's about.
It's possible. We don't know for sure because each of those guys has their own twist. And a bit of cruelty on his part, too. I mentioned it before, but he actually called Regina Walter's father. And anonymous calls. It was a private number that obviously he got from Regina. And he told him, the father, I've made some changes to her. I've cut her hair. He said that she is in a lot. And when the father asked, is my daughter alive? Rhodes hung up. So that is a bit of, again, that cruelty, the sadism, the things that he likes to do so much, he proves it there again. Look, this guy, he confessed to these murders. He confessed to them. They found things in his house. They found pictures. He really didn't have any problem in confessing to this stuff that he did. He was tried. He was convicted. He's doing life. They actually extradited him to Texas because the parents of one of the young ladies did not want to go through all the testimony, did not want to testify. They knew that he had other murders and he would never get out, and that was good enough for them. They didn't want to go through a process. So he went from Utah to Texas, and he was actually convicted and sentenced to life in prison. He is never getting out. I believe that he is now, well, he's very old now, if he's not dead by now, but I think that he's still alive. not a very good guy. A person who killed and tortured for many years. He was only convicted of 4 murders. But I, as I mentioned before, I don't believe that you should be fooled by that. He killed many more times. And the proof is that these young ladies that he killed were tortured in a certain way that suggests that he had no hesitation and that he already knew exactly what he's going to do. One of the FBI agents said that he had never seen such a meticulous rape kit as he carried. He carried a suitcase, actually, and it had different items, from handcuffs to chains to whips to sexual toys, etc. But it was so meticulous that he said, after so many years as an FBI agent, to this day, I still have not seen a kit so complete and so meticulous. Even Rhodes' ex-wife said he was meticulous, super clean about everything, which comes into the thing about the white towels. His apartment looked like, when she first started dating him, like it was just cleaned by a housekeeper. His truck, same thing, extremely meticulous.
Yeah. Yeah, I just, man, you know, truck stops are pretty... They're scary places. They have a kind of an otherworldly feel to them because, you know, if you go to one at night, it's going to be pitch black because you're in the middle of nowhere. But then there's these bright, blinding lights, and they, you know, they make everyone's skin look like vampires, and they're dirty, and there's freaks out in the parking lot, and there's people moving that are on hard times, and you know, there's just a lot of bad energy. Like I've been out on the road, you know, especially when I was younger, I couldn't afford a motel. I'm like, should I sleep at a truck stop where it's bright next to these long haulers, or, you know, because I know a lot of those guys, most of them good guys, some of them not, but, or, you know, just sleep like in the pitch blackness on the side of a highway, which is kind of like being alone in the woods. You know, neither feeling is great, but yeah, the truck stop. I've seen documentaries about lot lizards, and man, truck stops are fucked up, right?
Yeah, it's a very seedy scene, and everything from drug deals to sexual deals, prostitution, there is kidnapping, there is human trafficking. There is so much stuff going on in these places that it's a miracle that we don't have more information about it. It is a world in its own. As you mentioned, the lighting, everything, you walk in there. At first, you probably don't notice much. It's a diner, guys eat there, they leave. That looks pretty Americana, pretty normal. But if you know what you're looking for and you walk outside, especially if you're a former trucker or you just have the eyes to see it, you're going to see a lot of things going on. Drug deals, sex deals. You're going to see trucks with girls that, or boys in it that are very young. And, you know, most people don't want to get involved. And in those days, law enforcement didn't really look too hard there because, again, it's part of the sex trade. It's part of the, you know, people that are sex workers. So they figured they're a high-risk group. They're there because they want to be. If we arrest them, they're still going to go back to that place. So why try and help them? Well, the truth is that, well, shame on you, because a lot of those people in those truck stops are not there because they want to be. Some of them being kidnapped. Some of them are being held against their will. Maybe some of them are part of the sex trade, a sex industry that they do not want to be in. It's human trafficking. A lot of bad stuff happens in those places. And as we can see with Robert Ben Rhodes, he's just one element that exists there.
Yeah. So before we go, Rhodes, as far as truckers go, I'm going to guess, and let me know what your guess is, but your educated guess, but I would say there were maybe 4 or 5 contemporary trucker serial killers operating around that time. What do you think? And do you think he ever had any run-ins? Do you think they ever talked about this kind of stuff on the CB? Or, I mean, that'd be pretty dangerous, I guess. But do you think he was aware that other guys were doing this, like aware of who they were?
Absolutely. And I say this because some truckers are very, other serial killers that were truckers, there's a lot of them. There's more than four or five. There's a lot more. But that being said, most of them are very private. He was different because he was part of the BDSM scene. That leads to conversations. Because he's part of that scene, he had friends in that scene. And he probably talked to other truckers about it. Other truckers shared information with about what they liked. I think, yeah, I think he knew of other truckers that were doing similar things. And I said, like I said, I think he's different because he talks about it. He's involved in that scene. You have to confide in other, because you need other people to do that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I would say that other people knew about him and knew about, maybe not that he was a serial killer, but that he was involved in that scene. And maybe some other truckers knew possibly exactly what he was doing.
Yeah, well, that's such a easy lead-in, right? So if I was having a beer and some guy said he was into S&M, I might have a few questions. I might not. I might just decide not to talk to him. But that's such an easy segue to be like, oh, you like breaking bones? You know, some shit like that, right?
Well, no, they can say, well, you know, there is the... this bondage, but have you ever taken it to a different level? Right. See what kind of response he gets. There's a lot of ways to get into that conversation. I'm sure he did. He wasn't a dumb guy. He knew what he was doing, and he liked what he was doing most of all. So, stay away from truck stops.
Yeah, and he's still alive, so that's awesome. But he's on his way out. Anyway, yeah, thanks for suggesting that case, whoever that was. Really weird. Glad they caught him. He's got a lot of victims, but
you have 60 seconds remaining.
Yeah, stay away from truck stops. Anyway, until next time, I've been Matt Ralston.
And I'm William Noguera. Before I go, please sign up for my newsletter. You can be signed up at williamnoguera.com. I have my website back with my original name, so please check in. And until next time, be safe. Be aware of your surroundings. Your life could depend on it.